This is a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast.
From the team that brought you The Man of a Thousand Voices.
I'm Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves.
£1, one shilling.
Croc warfare in the moat. As colourful as any character in James Joyce's Dubliners.
This is Behind the Scenes, coming to a radio near you now.
Never has a behind the scenes gotten so much hype as the one we're running out today.
Well, yeah, and I'm worried it's not going to live up to it. But we are looking at which film, and this is such an arbitrary little thing to pop on it. And please don't go away and say, oh, it's 16 minutes. Oh, it's 7 minutes. We're looking at roughly the greatest opening scenes in cinema history. Okay, that's what we're doing here. I've said 10 minutes because that's enough time for a film to really make a splash.
I tell you what, I've gone through this feature. We're going to be here till 8 o'clock.
One or two spoiler alerts upcoming. We might have to skip through a few, but I've categorized them. So I'm going to kick things off with the genre that no one cares about, the horror genre.
A lot of people do, but
it's probably
most
the one
people
that,
don't.
You know, the Oscars don't give the horrors their due. You know, horror is it's a forgotten genre, or at least it's a maligned genre, I feel.
It's been sort of resigned to sequels of horror films from the 70s, basically.
Yeah. But there was one film that did the horror opening scene in a very unique, very, very creative way. And of course, I'm talking about Scream from 1996.
Why don't you want to talk to me?
Who is this?
You tell me your name, I'll tell you mine.
I don't think so.
What's that noise?
Popcorn.
You're making popcorn?
Uh-huh.
I only eat popcorn at the movies.
Well, I'm getting ready to watch a video.
Really? What?
Oh, just some scary movie.
Now, my question here is, why the heck would you continue a conversation with a bloke that sounds like a psychopath? So, you know, you're alone at night in a house where it's in the middle of nowhere, ostensibly.
With windows all over.
Yeah, and a guy calls you and just goes, what are you doing? Like, why the heck would you continue to talk to him?
I'm with you on that, Rob.
Imagine that. You could try 100 numbers and you'd have the phone put down on you 100 times out of 100 if you went, why are you doing?
I really want to call somebody at random now and just have Rob go,
What are you doing?
We should try it on this show.
It was a very clever way of starting that. You know, I mean, it's been ripped off and parodied and copied and imitated beyond belief. But Drew Barrymore was the most famous actress in that movie, and they obviously, spoiler alert, but they killed her off within about 6 minutes of the film starting. So, you know, they were very bold in their approach to the film, and obviously Wes Craven, very, very famous and creative horror director. And, you know, I would say that that's certainly up there in terms of the horror movie genre's best opening scene. Sentimental, I'm going to throw you the mic here, Soane, because I'm going to say we're doing the film that you actually mentioned originally, and I'm going to ask you to explain in less than a minute why it's so great. I'm talking about the movie Up, with the very sentimental musical Bed playing in the background.
Now, of course, this is an animation, and I think what makes it so special is you see this love story that unfolds, but it's not cheesy. There's something real about it. It's as a couple first meets, they have their early sort of fun moments. You see dashed hopes and dreams, but you also see the realities of life that have taken their place that are just as meaningful as sort of traveling the world or the big sort of dreams that they have. And it's done in these cute little short vignettes where you see little moments that are all kind of put together in the making of a life and the life that two people create together. And it's incredible in just a couple of minutes how they managed to show you a couple's entire life and the bond that they shared and why they were so important to each other.
I completely concur. I would add that you also, your own life in a way flashes before your eyes a little bit. And, you know, the tragedy of kind of life in general is just beautifully encapsulated, isn't it?
Yeah.
Like it's sort of the inevitability of, like, you know, where all relationships end up going in the end. It's just, it makes you feel really sad, really to your core. And actually, it made me not want to watch the rest of the movie. That's the one criticism that I would have. I mean, it's an absolute, it's maybe the greatest tearjerker. And usually a tearjerker in a film would come towards the end.
Yeah.
You know, towards the climactic moment of the film. It hits you right out the gate.
Yeah, it really does. It just hits you in the gut. The thing is, it is sad, but it's that kind of beautiful sad as opposed to sad sad.
Agreed. Yeah.
You know?
No, totally. It is. Although I was still extremely annoyed at both you and Rog for making me watch it during a nice contented afternoon in the office. I still remember that. I'm still not quite over that. I wasn't ready for it.
Oh, and yet you put it in your list of the best opening scenes.
It is because it's, as someone on the comments of the video on YouTube said, they made a better love story in the opening scene than most movies do in their entire runtime.
And that's true.
They just condensed it, didn't they? And that's the beauty of animation in a way.
Yeah.
But and that music as well. There's something about that music that gets you.
Yeah,
I'm not
definitely sure.
It's just, it's wistful. It's whimsical, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely.
And then it kind of, oh, anyway, we won't go into it. It's making me sad even talking
again about
it.
Let's give him a moment, I think.
But there's about 97 films we still haven't covered. So we're going to go from sentimental to action, thriller, universe, and this.
To believe in things, honor, respect. Look at you. What do you believe in, huh? What do you believe in?
I believe whatever doesn't kill you simply makes you a stranger.
I'm going to ask Chris why this is such a powerful opening scene.
It's just, we're introduced to the Joker, we're introduced to Heath Ledger's iteration of the Joker, and it's that scene in the bank, isn't it, where you've got all these guys in masks. And of course, they're all, spoiler alert, they all kind of kill one another, and you're left with the Joker leaving in the back of a school bus. The school bus pulls out of the bank, joins a fleet of other school buses, so he gets away with it, and the anarchy and the chaos with which it's going to ensue over the course of the next 3 hours is encapsulated in that kind of opening 7-8 minutes.
I feel like, you know, in the action thriller genre, you feel like you've seen it so many times before, and then you saw that scene and you thought, I haven't seen this one before.
Exactly that. And you're like, yes, right, the Joker is here, Heath Ledger. Even in that little couple of minutes, you're excited. You're like, yeah, he looks the part. He looks great. This is going to be, it's going to be something
and
special.
And the other thing, and I was reading up on it earlier, and I guess this is, I suppose, a consequence of it being a sequel to Batman Begins. No Batman in that opening scene. Right. I mean, Batman in all of his movies is part and parcel of the opening scene. He's the reveal. In the 1989 Batman, he swoops down and he's the guy. Whereas it really just kind of stamps an alternative angle on the film when you make the antagonist the central cog of the opening scene.
And the Joker's so iconic, they can pull it off as well.
And really, I mean, that film, not only is it arguably the greatest superhero film, it also completely revitalized and actually fueled Hollywood's complete obsession with the superhero genre for the next decade, you could argue, because it came out in 2008. And then for the next 10 years, Hollywood was absolutely awash with superhero movies.
And not only that, I think it was that particular movie, that portrayal from Heath Ledger of that character that has led to the Joaquin Phoenix Joker, the focus in on the character, the arch villain, if you will, in itself. And that's just a great movie. Mm. We've talked about it to death. Amazing.
In action, I just wanted to give a shout out to the Bourne Ultimatum, Chris.
The
Waterloo train station. You know, frenetic, high drama, brilliantly shot, you know, everything, so many moving parts, and then just so much information and tension and kind of drama compressed into that opening 10 minutes where it's at this busy train station. You've got CIA tracking Jason Bourne and he's on a train, and like, it's all, you know, it just hits the, again, because it's a sequel, it hits the ground running. And they're just continuing. They're picking up where they left off.
Exactly.
And they don't have to frame anything or set anything up. And actually linked to that is James Bond. We've had a couple of messages in on this. 007 films, known for their spectacular opening set piece. And then obviously there is the first time we're introduced to Bond in the first film in 1962, Dr. No.
I admire your courage, Miss...
Trench. Sylvia Trench. I admire your luck, Mr...
Bond. James Bond.
Mr. Bond, I suppose you wouldn't care to raise the limit?
I have no objections.
I mean, it's arguably the coolest 30 seconds in cinema history. Just the shot of Sean Connery with the fag just drooping out of the corner of his mouth. It's just amazing. I would urge you, if you haven't seen it, just to go and watch it, just because it's just... Talk about encapsulating a character and just embodying a character in like 10 seconds.
Yeah.
Just the expression on his face. Mm. You know, Bond. And then It's just like, it's almost like he can't be bothered to smoke the cigarette. It's just drooping. It's dangling. It's hanging precariously on the edge of his mouth.
To be clear as well, so if you, and obviously you're now a taken woman, you're now married, but if you were out in the dating scene and a bloke introduced himself as Greenfield Robbie, I mean, is that, that's a red flag to me.
Yeah.
You know, the name's Rubani. Well, Sono Rubani.
Yeah. Yeah. You sound like an absolute bleep, don't you?
Yeah, you sound like an absolute numpty.
Yeah, he somehow gets away with it, but he's only throwing it back at her.
True. Yeah, exactly. She's,
anyway, that wasn't the Bond I wanted to focus on. The Bond I wanted to focus on was the reinvention of Bond in Casino Royale, where you might recall they've got this parkour scene where it's high octane. They actually admit because Bourne had launched before Daniel Craig took over from Pierce Brosnan. In the intervening years, Bond suddenly looked very dated. Mm. Brosnan's Bond looked compared to the spy genre and the spy thriller genre with Jason Bourne and Matt Damon, Bond suddenly looked like well behind the time. So they thought, how can we just take this and do it even better? And that's why they ended up with this spectacular opening scene to Casino Royale, where there's like a high elevation chase and fight on the cranes.
The guy that's running away is actually the parkour world champion.
Yes, he is.
Guy.
Correct. Well done. Yeah, good knowledge there. Yeah, very, very good. So yeah, he is. So that's definitely worthy of a mention in the action genre, the Bond genre. When it comes to crime, I just want to ask this simple question. Which Scorsese gangster epic did it better? You've got both of these films involve cars, a main character, and a monologue. Here's the first one.
When you love someone, you've got to trust them. There's no other way. You've got to give them the key to everything that's yours. Otherwise, what's the point? And for a while, I believed that's the kind of love I had.
That is Robert De Niro leaving his house, getting into a car with the monologue. Car explodes, and that's the opening scene in the film. Or this.
As far back as I can remember, I always wanted to be a gangster.
Another tactic there, where it jumps in straight into the middle of the film.
Yeah.
It's like you're watching it and you're thinking, what the heck's going on here? It's four blokes in a car driving out of town. It's all looking pretty shady, and they stop and there's a guy in the boot.
Yeah.
And there's no context. There's no. They don't frame it at all. They just jump straight into the middle of the movie, and then you catch up to
piece
that point.
Piece it together, right?
But
I'm
going
to say Goodfellas between the two. I mean, they're both great, but I'm going to go with Goodfellas if I had to choose.
It's so iconic, isn't it?
Yeah.
With Ray Liotta.
It's amazing.
It's just brilliant. So, I mean, that would be, for me, certainly up there. And I wanted to kind of finish this feature with the battle of the legendary directors. Because, you know, when it comes to opening scene mastery, I feel like two filmmakers do stand out. So in the blue corner, you've got Jaws, Raiders of the Lost Ark, Saving Private Ryan.
Mm.
You've got Stevie Spielberg.
Stevie, yeah, love it.
In the red corner, you've got Inglourious, Pulp Fiction, Reservoir Dogs, Kill Bill. You've got Quentin Tarantino.
Quentin, like it.
Now, I mean, I think Jaws might not get... You might not think about Jaws when you think about a brilliant first scene, but when you actually think of how revolutionary it was at the time back in 1975, it opens with a point of view tracking shot through the ocean. If we could just play the bed here. So it could be in the point of view of the shark, but it could also be a snorkeler. You don't really know, but you're immediately taken to those memories. If you ever as a kid frolicked in the ocean,
many times in the ocean.
And obviously you've got this great film score playing, but then at the end the camera kind of points down into the depths and it cuts straight to the beach where they're...
So you get this tantalizing prospect of what lurks beneath.
Yeah,
there's no answers, basically.
Then, exactly, no answers, fun on the beach. Then obviously that attack that you never see the shark. You do not see the shark until 1 hour, 21 minutes into the movie, which is interesting, isn't
it? It's amazing.
It's great. It's... It's just like he did with Jurassic Park, where you don't see the T-Rex until, you know, at least that amount of time into the film as well. Raiders is just brilliant. I mean, Harrison Ford, Indiana Jones, the bullwhip, the kind of misty mountain, the
That's
great opening
such
scene.
Such a great opening scene where he's like chased by the boulder.
Yeah, Yeah, there's definitely that. And then the Private Ryan one, I mean, a lot of people have mentioned it. Funnily enough, the D-Day landing is not the opening scene of Saving Private Ryan. Everyone thinks it is, but and that's because it's so powerful. The opening scene is the older Tom Hanks is, I can't remember the name of his character.
Oh, that's right.
He's visiting the cemetery.
That's right.
And that's a good 5 minutes. The D-Day landing, he gets the flashback. It's still amazing, but it's the film doesn't start with the D-Day landing. Mm. And the D-Day landing is a 25-minute scene. So it's almost disqualified from being considered here in a weird way.
Because it to 10 minutes. Just arbitrarily.
Yeah, I mean, we're the Oscars, essentially. We're the off-script Oscars. And we're sorry, Stephen, but you've overindulged there. 25 minutes is far too long. But yeah, I mean, we've talked a lot about Saving Private Ryan. I think it was one of the features we did in Behind the Scenes, one of the films we did early on. That 5 minute scene with the elderly man in the military cemetery who turns out to be Tom Hanks' character, that is actually the opening scene in Saving Private Ryan. And then Inglourious Basterds, just to quickly finish, Quentin Tarantino movies, well known for their brilliant opening scenes. But, you know, most fans are split between Inglourious and Pulp Fiction when it comes to the best of them all.
What do you think? What would you give your vote?
I would go with Inglourious.
So would I.
Mm.
Yes,
I would, because obviously it's... And also, I would ask you this question. Is there a better breakout role from an already established actor who's never been in a mainstream film than Christoph Waltz in Inglourious?
Jeepers, Rob. You're throwing that one out there.
While you think about it, let's play this clip.
I might add also that any information that makes a performance of my duty easier will not be met with punishment. Actually, quite the contrary. It will be met with reward. And that reward will be your family will cease to be harassed in any way by the German military during the rest of our occupation of your country. You're sheltering enemies of the state, are you not?
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, it's just so... The way it builds up... It's actually a technique that was debuted by Alfred Hitchcock. It's called vicarious suspense. And ultimately, the way he did it was a technique known as the bomb under the table, where the director reveals to the audience a key detail of the scene, i.e., in this case, the family hiding under the floorboards.
That's right.
And then we know they're there... He ostensibly doesn't know they're there, and then it kind of builds to a crescendo, and then of course we know all along that he knew they were there.
Yeah.
And it just kind of, the way it just gets there, very from cordiality to then, you know, the ultimate sort of brutality in the end. But yeah, what would get your vote out of all those ones we've just whistled through there?
It's a tough one, but I'm going to say Inglourious.
Inglourious.
Yeah, it's tough.
Too.
You need to put Stevie against Quinty. You know, where do you go with that? But I think Inglourious one just stands out of all of the sort of different films that you just talked about between
yeah.
them.
Yeah.
I think on that one, when you watch that, you think, wow, I'm in for an incredible film experience here.
Yeah.
Like it leaves you under no doubt that you are watching just a brilliant film.
No doubt. Yeah. I need to go back and watch Inglourious. It's been
a
while.
It sets it up so well.
It's amazing.
Sets the tone so well, I think, as well.
I would argue, actually, that the middle part of that film actually is the weaker kind
loses
of
its way
part
a little,
of it.
Yeah.
It's brilliant at the end as well, when he gets his comeuppance. But the middle part loses me a little bit, I have to say.
Yeah.
The Offscript Podcast.
No mystery, just history on Offscript.
Now, I'm going to talk about a couple geniuses and certain unexpected things about them. Leonardo da Vinci, if he was your buddy, you went around to see him. I mean, what are you expecting? You're expecting some intellectual conversation, perhaps. Maybe you think he's going to show off some of his artwork as he's working on it to you. Get your thoughts, you know? You're maybe
why would
not,
he get our thoughts?
You know, well, in this hypothetical,
see this
you're
masterpiece.
His mate.
What do you think? How do I improve it?
Don't you know what I mean? Purple penis.
Here's his buddy. Everybody's got a buddy that they're they show their work to.
Yeah, true.
Yeah. You're probably not expecting him to pull out his quote-unquote pet dragon.
Right. Jeepers. Wondered where you're going with that, Soans.
That's his name for it, you know.
Yeah.
That's what he likes to call it. His pet dragon, which he has made, and essentially frighten you away with it. But that's something he quite liked to do, apparently. He had a pet lizard, And he actually made it wings made from the skins of other lizards.
That's weird.
Then he added something called quicksilver so that when the animal would walk, the wings would also kind of move a bit along. It had a bit of like, life
off
to
now.
It. Yeah.
He really is.
And then he'd also make horns and a little beard for it. And he tamed the lizard and kept it, you know, kept it in a little cage. And then when his friends came around, he would show it to them and they would just, you know, be spooked by it. Naturally,
I mean,
a dragon lizard, or as he called it, his pet dragon.
Well, there is such a lizard called a bearded dragon, which I think resembles a little bit like a dragon.
Oh, there you go.
But he obviously didn't.
He was onto something.
There was no bearded dragons available in his particular pet shop, so he had to improvise. Clearly.
He had to improvise, and you know, who knows? This could be a metaphor for something else, but in this situation, he's just showing everybody his pet dragon. Yeah. Okay, and it's very literal. Let's move on to Nikola Tesla. Who...
That was literal, not little. Literal, yeah. Okay.
Nikola Tesla needs no introduction, right? Just accomplished scientist, inventor. He invented the Tesla coil, electric oscillators. Some of the technologies that he developed were eventually found in X-rays and radio. He's had so much impact on our day-to-day life and does still. But one thing he also suffered from, or one thing he did suffer from, sorry, was financial problems. And this was mostly later in his life. Now, in 1915, he had a tower plant that was sold off to help pay off $20,000 of debt at the Waldorf Astoria. It seemed he'd like to live in hotels, I guess,
yeah.
Because according to this, he went into a lot of debt, not just at the Waldorf, where he eventually paid it off. But by the 1930s, he once again had quite a sizable bill at a hotel called the Governor Clinton Hotel in Manhattan in New York. Now, he just couldn't afford the payment. So you're something of a genius. You have a reputation. What do you do? Well, he went ahead and negotiated with the management and said, listen, I've got an item to leave for collateral. If something happens to me and I'm not able to pay off my debt, you know what? You can take this. It's one of my inventions. You can sell it off. And don't worry, you're covered. You don't have to worry about my debt. Okay? That was the kind of discussion he had with them. And at the time, he was working on something he called Teleforce. And he described this as, and I quote here, a death beam that was both thinner than a hair and also powerful enough to destroy anything approaching within 200 miles.
It was basically the laser in Goldfinger.
I haven't seen Goldfinger, but maybe
you
it
know
is.
The one that's basically pointed at Sean Connery's crotch and
yes.
It's moving very slowly. Up the table,
yeah,
like
yeah.
Really slowly.
Yeah,
that's the
and
same movie as
Goldfinger. Then leaves the room rather than wait to see it. You know, get to its conclusion.
Finish the job. Yeah,
yeah. He leaves and allows James Bond to wriggle free.
That's the infamous line. What do you want? I want you to know.
No, he goes. Do you expect me to talk? No, oh. Mr. Bond. I expect you to die.
There we go.
And then he leaves the room.
I am enjoying that Chiron's messaging in to say fact on this one. He thought the first one was fiction. Because that a nod to Sonal Rabbani earlier this week. This is no, what is it? No mystery, just history.
No mystery, just history. All
this
facts.
This is all facts.
All facts, all around here. All right, so he's working on Teleforce, this sort of death beam. He's claiming this could make warfare obsolete, kind of that idea of mutual, what's the term I'm looking for?
Well, he was a bit out if he's claiming it could make warfare obsolete. He was making that claim in the start of the 20th century.
Yeah, well, it did.
Mutually beneficial?
Really. No, when you... it'll come to me. Anyways, he told them that the device was a prototype, that he had a prototype of it. It was hanging out in his hotel room. Now, if I was the hotel management, I'd be alarmed by that.
It was
in this
hanging
case,
out in his hotel room.
Yeah, he's saying he had it in his hotel room. He did say, though, it's extremely dangerous. Don't try to open it. If you try to open it, you don't know what it could destroy. So he said, again, if something happened to him, they could just take it, though, and sell it off. So when he did die in 1943 in said hotel, an MIT scientist was actually called up by the FBI to look through his belongings and also to check out this claim of this death ray that he was, or this death beam, I should say, that he was working on. And he was sent to Tesla's hotel room to assess this potentially dangerous weapon. That man was John G. Trump, uncle. To the Donald.
No
way.
Yeah. He actually wrote in a book of his that, you know, at that point when he was opening up this case, he took some time to reflect upon his life because he didn't know what it was going to happen. Tesla said he could do it. You believed he could do it, right? So he and Dr. Trump, incidentally, was a renowned professor of engineering and a physicist. He specialized in high voltage phenomena, designed X-ray generators for cancer therapy. He was.
What would he make of his nephew?
I mean, seriously, he was a brilliant man. And during World War II,
his nephew did become president of the United
no,
States.
No, true,
so
but I mean,
begrudging respect.
A renowned professor of engineering and physicist. You
know, that's great. I was an engineer and a physicist.
And he tunes in and sees Donald on The Apprentice.
And then going on to become president. Begrudging respect, I'm sure.
Yeah, begrudging respect.
So Donald Trump's uncle is sitting there going through Nikola Tesla's stuff when he's died, because he was chosen by the FBI to examine these belongings. And the only thing he found was a wooden chest that had a note on it, basically, that claimed that this was worth $10,000. Do not open, basically. Open at your own peril. He does open it, and it just has a simple tool for measuring electrical resistance. It was a typical lab electric sort of material. It was nothing. It was essentially junk. Tesla had thrown some old junk in a fancy box and convinced everyone it was a death beam, and then got away with tens of thousands of dollars worth of hotel bills.
Brilliant. Yeah, I mean, it's got to be worth, even back then, it's got to be worth more than $10,000. If it's a death beam, if it's really what he says it is, if it can.
Exactly.
And by the way, we've actually been rescued by a listener, Mutually Assured Destruction.
Yes. Thank you.
I can't believe you looked at me and Chris for help there, as if we were going to come up with that.
Mutually beneficial is what I said. No, mutually assured destruction. Okay. No, that was way off. My apologies.
Mutual deterrence.
That's I mean, even back then, he could have gotten millions, couldn't he, for a genuine death beam?
Exactly. If somebody's claiming he's got this and it's worth $10,000 already, you should kind of be like,
suspicions should be aroused.
Exactly.
Where are we turning to other historical pranksters, so?
We're looking at how Virginia Woolf, the famed author, you might know A Room of One's Own, Mrs. Dalloway, for example, To the Lighthouse, just a few of the things that she's penned. When she got together with a bunch of her writing friends, about six of them in total, and decided they were going to dupe the military so that they could have a little, you know, have a good time on a naval ship, basically.
Oh, yeah.
Now, the Dreadnought hoax of February 1910 was when they basically all got dressed up, put some beards on, turbans, kaftans, and disguised themselves as Abyssinian princes. Now, they went ahead and went to the British military because they wanted to get on board the HMS Dreadnought, and told them that and Abyssinians, you know, now Ethiopia, but back then it was known as Abyssinia. They claimed to be princes, and two of them foreign office guides and translators.
Brilliant.
So for some reason, none of this was checked out. I mean, they were even kind of just in darkened makeup. You might call it blackface.
Yeah.
So they just kind of darkened their skin a bit, threw some beards on. I guess these disguises were good enough that nobody seemed to question it. They were welcomed on board, given red carpet treatment. A band played for them. The crew saluted them. African flags were hoisted. They were invited to dine, but they actually turned it down. Now, they said in this kind of fake mumbo jumbo Swahili that they were speaking, they had kind of studied a couple words of Swahili, and from there were just making gibberish up as they were on board.
And they were still being feted over. They were still...
Yeah, absolutely.
What?
They had...
Sign of the times.
The crew and the people in charge had no idea about this. Can you imagine something like this happening today? I mean, you would get
J.K.
arrested.
Rowling?
Yeah, seriously. Imagine J.K. Rowling and George Martin just kind of
putting a beard on
up
and getting into the president's breakfast or something.
Exactly. Just kind of fooling their way in.
You just would
never think of that today.
No.
But anyways, they declined dinner because they were worried their fake beards would fall off. Now, finally, they got off the ship after having a great old time and having quite a laugh. In fact, one of the people involved in this who wrote a letter about it said they were talking gibberish fluently. It was glorious, shriekingly funny. I nearly howled when introducing the four princes to the admiral and then to the captain, for I had made their names up in the train, but I forgot which was which and introduced them under various names, but it did not matter.
And they just took them in. See, pranks of this nature weren't of the times, right? So
yeah.
This was... taking it face value.
Yeah, it did eventually get reported, the hoax, just days later. So, of course, it was a bit of an embarrassment to the British military when
did
happen.
I can imagine.
Yeah. A little last one for you. This is we're moving on to quite a fascinating character, whereas you might not know his name.
Okay.
William Buckland. Does it ring a bell for you?
Funnily enough, that does ring a bell, but I'm not sure why.
I'll tell you why, because he is the geologist and paleontologist who first described the dinosaur. And you think, describe the dinosaur, what does that mean? Sure, they had found fossils, but they hadn't really figured out what they were. He was the first one to sort of put two and two together, and he described it before the word dinosaur was there. He described it as a megalosaurus fossil, and he knew something interesting was happening. He chose the name which meant great lizard. So it was kind of first establishing the concept, the idea of a dinosaur. Okay. He was also an eccentric who was known to try to eat anything. Absolutely anything. I'm not going to go into that because you guys will be grossed out. I've learned where to hold back on such things.
He would just
by all means, go for it.
He was really fascinated with the idea of trying to eat everything he could ever eat. So he would have mice on toast. That was a snack that he enjoyed. I'm not going to go into the time that he attempted to eat a king's mummified heart.
What?
But I'll just leave it there. What? You said go in. I said I was holding myself back and you urged me to continue.
Mice on toast.
Oh, sardines on toast is bad enough, but mice. Oh.
Anyways, so that was just an aside, the fact that he enjoyed eating absolutely anything. He was fascinated by animals, but also their byproducts.
Oh, really?
So he, you know, for example, there's an oft-told story about the time he visited a European cathedral that was very famous for this kind of puddle of liquid that continually collected on the floor. Now, of course, the cathedral made use of this and they called it martyr's blood, as if it was a sort of spiritual, mystical thing. He kneels down, simply licks the liquid on the floor and confidently claims that that is, in fact, bat urine.
Oh, how the heck does he know what urine species that belongs to?
Well, he liked to taste things, so who knows? Maybe he had some priors with that. So there was no surprise here that he was fascinated by guano. This was during his university days. He went to Oxford. Now, guano is seabird waste, essentially. It's full
and
of nitrogen.
He was fascinated by it.
Yeah, well, back then, the idea of fertilizing with waste wasn't really a known thing in England. It was full of nitrogen,
you should have stuck
phosphate,
with dinosaur,
potassium.
Frankly. That was...
I mean, I wish I didn't ask about this bloke.
he would have had a big enough claim to fame just with Terrible Lizard.
Yeah, exactly.
Without all of this nonsense.
Billy Buckland. Needed his head tested, this bloke.
Yeah, he was quite an eccentric, certainly. He was a fascinating fellow. But these he realized in this guano, as it was called, it was well known in South America that it had been used as fertilizer for centuries. There was a geographer who returned from Peru who brought this knowledge to England, but nobody really took note. Good old Willie Buckland did take note, and he wanted to prove that this was actually an incredible substance to use when coming to agriculture. So he went to Oxford, and again, this is an era in which distributing animal feces on a lawn was just not the done thing.
Oh, really?
And he carefully spells out guano on the grass using guano. And though that may have been cleaned up eventually, he made his point, because by springtime, they saw that green message of guano in the grass. It had grown that much more impressively than the rest of the grass surrounding it, that sort of was inked into the grass itself.
He used bat guano?
Yeah.
So he had a real fascination with bats.
Yeah.
I mean, didn't really matter what bat excretion it was.
No.
This guy was all over it.
He was.
He was on board.
He was. Yeah.
Okay.
It's an interesting little kind of
He's
trying to prove
boy.
A point.
Is that a prank zone or is that just a complete and utter odd job?
Yeah.
I think a bit of both.
That's just a bloke who's got a weird...
I just think you stumbled across him and thought, I can weird the blokes out. I'm going to just shoehorn in.
He wasn't playing a prank at all. He was conducting a scientific experiment.
Oh, God.
Oh, my God.
You know, through a
mice
lawn,
and toast.
Putting some feces on lawn that he wasn't supposed to.
I'm sure that's had a massive ramification historically. Wow. Oh, good old Willie Buckland.
The Off-Script Podcast.
Ooh, it's another study duddy. Oh, tell us something we don't know. I don't care what your study tells us anyway. I don't care about that.
Now, to call this a study would be incredibly generous, but it's been referred to as such, so I will also do the same. This is from Rentola, which I've never heard of, but it's a rental platform. And they looked at what they called the safest and the most dangerous places in the UK if there were ever a zombie apocalypse. Now, you're both from the UK. Do you have any ideas in mind, any kind of thoughts about where you would run and hide to?
Northeast of Scotland.
Mm.
Rough terrain.
Some kind of outpost like the Isle of Skye.
Indeed, just get away from it all.
Yeah, or maybe the Outer Hebrides. I can't imagine a zombie would bother to go up that far north.
Just go remote.
Why go to just where you can find rocky outcrops and a bunch of sheep?
Exactly.
You're actually onto something with that,
by the way.
Just getting away from the urban environment is critical. Well, we'll come back to that, but first let's get to this study. Now, they analyzed...
Do we need a pen and paper for this? Or?
Maybe eventually. Not quite yet. We will get to that part where we will actually get into how to survive a zombie apocalypse. And that, according to an expert, by the way, not something I just entirely made up on my own. Now, Rentola, this rental platform, analyzed 6 categories of data: vulnerability, hideouts, supplies, safety, mobility, and hazards. Now, what did they decide was the safest location? You guys are going to have to help me out with this because I'm obviously not that familiar with the UK. But Uttlesford?
Yeah.
In Essex. Apparently. And it's known for being where celebrity chef Jamie Oliver grew up.
Interesting.
Well, as if that's a reference to anybody.
If he's still there, I mean, and if I was a zombie, I'd be making a beeline to eat Jamie Oliver.
Why?
Why? Because you would acquire his cooking skills?
No, because I would imagine that zombies would target celebrities.
No, they target anyone
and
anything.
Anyone in front of them.
Exactly. They're not going to just pick celebs only to feast upon, Rob.
If anything, maybe you want Jamie Oliver in your survival crew so he can cook for you.
Well, there is
that. You can keep the crew fed. You know, that's something to think of as well. Now, of course, Uttlesford is known as a quaint countryside area. Remote farmhouses, food supplies, handy road links, all things you need to be thinking of, they say. There were people that actually responded to this. A guy who's a 52-year-old ex-zombie actor called Mark Ropkins, who's from the area, says, knowing where the safest place offers me some comfort.
Okay.
It's good to know. Another place that's known as the least safe place to be or the worst place to be in the UK is Craven, North Yorks.
Right.
Any familiarity with this area?
No, I do not.
Yeah, it's one of the least densely populated areas in England. So on one hand, it's remote. That means it should be good being rural, right? But there just isn't enough in terms of supplies to keep residents alive. So it's got caves and waterfalls, beautiful nature. Just not enough going on for you to survive
in that. So you're going to strike that balance.
But, yeah.
Okay. Right. So you got to get... But you just need a safe house, don't you, at the end of the day?
You need food.
You need a convenience store.
Yeah.
An abandoned convenience store.
With loads of food in it.
I want you to think about where you would go. What would your safe kind of bunker be here in the UAE? Okay, we're going to go through this bit by bit. And this is according to the zombie survival expert, Lewis Dartnell. He's the author of The Knowledge, How to Rebuild Our World After an Apocalypse. So he's written a book on this sort of thing. And he's gotten serious with his advice. Okay, step one. First of all, in the beginning stages, the outbreak has just happened. The zombies have just started to emerge. First of all, you want to lay low.
Yeah.
You want to make sure you're prepped with a couple days of supplies.
Don't buy up the entire line of loo roll from the local supermarket.
No, don't do that.
We've seen how ridiculous people are in the first couple of months of the pandemic zone.
Yeah, but if it's a zombie apocalypse, you're doing just that. You're taking anything you can get your hands on.
You're hunkering down.
But just imagine what chaos there would be.
Yeah, but
if a zombie apocalypse
was well, that's
you're
the point.
You're avoiding
you want to be
chaos.
The winner.
You're in. You're getting your loo roll. You're getting your few days of supplies.
Yep. So you're preempting it. You're almost anticipating.
That's it. You're getting home.
Blacking out the windows.
Yeah, you are.
With some bin liner. You're barricading your doors. You're hunkering down for a few days. This is a temporary situation. Chris is getting this. I can feel it already.
I'm absolutely getting this. I'm taking notes.
Yeah. So the next thing you want to do now, once the chaos is kind of started, but things are kind of starting to mellow down, a new normal is emerging at this point. He says, step two, is to get your route out of town or the city. You don't want to be in a crowded area, so you want to get a little bit outside of that. But you also need something of a base. Ideally, a quiet rural spot, somewhere that you've got some clear running water, a wall potentially surrounding your settlement.
So you need a holiday home, essentially.
You need a castle and a moat to Scotland, it is then.
Yeah.
I mean, if you were in the UAE, though, where are you going? I was thinking, hear me out with this. Okay, not out of town, not rural. You're still staying in the city, but Topgolf, okay? Because you're Topgolf,
most visited establishment in the UAE, probably.
No, everything is settled. The people have cleared out, okay? There's no people left. This is just an abandoned Topgolf at this point, okay? Mm. And you're getting on, like, the top floor of it where you can see if there's an invasion
coming. Unlimited rage balls.
You think about there's a way to entertain yourself because also you're going to get bored while you're hunkering down.
Just to pop a
You'd
little.
Be a tour pro by the time you left.
Yeah. Think of the quantity of food that's already stocked
right.
in that place.
Spanner in the works here, Sons. First things first.
I don't
first.
Think tater tots are lasting more than about 3 days.
Just with the quantity of tater tots that they have, if it's just you and your crew.
Whilst you look out on the vista of the Dubai landscape, right? Just a word of warning. There's another 180 degrees behind you that you have no view of as they come up the stairs.
No, but I'm sure there's a way to get on the
no,
roof, right?
No.
Is there not?
No.
You're top, a tad bit exposed, aren't you?
Yeah, but you're at the
top. I need
top.
Shade.
You're at the top, you know? And zombies are lumbering slow creatures going for whatever's next to them. They're not going to climb to the top of Topgolf.
Anyone from Topgolf, if you are tuned in, congratulations. You've just been designated the safest place to hang out in the event of a zombie apocalypse.
I'm waiting for a better idea from one of you two.
Well, first and foremost, just to be clear, if we're comparing and contrasting this with the COVID pandemic, we all know that the three of us would get special dispensation and we'd have to be on air telling the world that there is a zombie
Actually,
apocalypse.
Yeah, I was going to say, would this studio be...
We'd be doing a quiz.
No, this studio would not be a bolt hole.
We'd be doing a quiz and we'd be updating everyone.
Security is pretty lax around here. You can stroll in here. I mean, I don't think they'd turn a zombie away, quite frankly.
I wonder, where is the safest place? I'm going to need to have a little think of this. Certainly it isn't Topgolf, Sons.
Okay, well, whatever. I'm just throwing something out there to get it started. Somebody come up with something better and we'll discuss. But for now, it's the only thing that's on the board, right? Okay, another thing you need to think about is your crew. Because obviously you're not surviving the apocalypse alone. You need a pretty small, close-knit team. You don't want it sprawling. You don't want too many sort of loose people hanging around creating, drawing attention to yourself. You want a tight-knit crew, like-minded. Everybody's bringing a skill to the table. Also, you got to think about who's the liability on your team. You need to be ruthless.
Okay.
If there's a liability, you got to let them go.
I think we can all safely say at this point that we would all be abandoning each other.
Yes.
At the first.
Yeah.
I'm taking Ant Middleton. If Ant, who lives out here, he's in my crew.
I'm taking
you listening, Ant.
Bear Grylls.
Who else in your phone book, Chris? Quite an extensive phone book of yours.
Aunt Middleton is in said phone book, so Aunt gets a call.
Rob's called him first.
Okay. Aunt, I'm phoning Aunt and asking where Foxy is. That's his right-hand man in SAS.
Okay.
Okay, I'm just doing the 6 degrees of separation here. I'd be asking where Foxy is, flying him in. He's my first bloke. Just a big burly bloke to help us survive. I am
like a doorman.
Exactly that. I'm needing as many burly blokes who know how to survive in the rugged terrain.
Yeah. But you don't want them seeing you as the weakest link. You gotta have some balance, otherwise they're throwing you overboard from the top of Topgolf.
I am dead within 24 hours then.
Yeah.
We all know I am the ultimate.
Chris stocking up on like all the sort of like really hard, tough fellas in his phone book. And as soon as they congregate in one group, they'll be like, why the heck are we indulging this bloke?
I'm the quiz master.
What's he bringing to the table?
Yeah. I'm giving them sports quizzes.
Oh dear.
Okay.
Who else am I bringing? I am probably bringing a chef. A Jamie Oliver, twinned with a Foxy.
Yeah.
Solid.
Okay.
Yeah, chef's a decent shout. Yeah. I don't happen to have any good chefs in my phone book.
You need somebody who can be inventive also because you don't know what supplies you're going to have. You know, somebody who can rustle up something from almost nothing.
Yeah.
Pick a couple flowers and branches and make something.
There is always a line that we often flirt with when it comes to the quality of the content on this show. And for Stephen, it feels like we've crossed that line. He's been in touch to say, love the show, but zombie apocalypse, no. This is absolute codswallop. Although, Stephen, I hate to say it, but it's actually elicited a lot of responses.
Oh, that's brilliant.
People are thinking. My uncle has been in touch to say, ski Dubai, top of the slope, zombies couldn't climb up. They'd slip. If one did reach the top, I'd ski down and take the chair back up.
Imagine. The problem with that is you're going to just stay on top of the slope. Wait, what are you eating, marshmallow? I mean, what are you doing?
I suppose you could somehow melt the snow and drink it.
What? Okay, yeah. I mean, you're not going
to have a celebrity chef up there with you, and when you ran out of supplies, you'd send them down to go and gather some extra stuff.
And then they would be a zombie and...
Take danger trips into Mall of the Emirates from Ski Dubai from time to time. David said it's got to be IKEA, endless supplies of meatballs and shawarmas, comfy sleeping arrangements, and should the zombies find their way in, the great news is they won't find their way out of the infinite maze between picture frames and bedding, allowing you to casually walk out of the lower level collecting a bag of dime bars.
It's interesting he mentions meatballs and shawarmas. I would say the hot dogs, and this is an ultimate free plug, the hot dogs in IKEA are unbelievable. Really? They're like 12 dirhams a pop.
It's the ice creams that always blow me away, because they're only a dirham, aren't they?
It's incredible. Honestly, that place.
Although I can't imagine the staff would still be serving said snacks.
No, I mean, you kind of help yourself, Rob, in this situation, okay?
Yeah, but ice creams, you know.
But I think IKEA's the winner so far based on the reactions in the studio.
Well, according to Matt's, if you want a good vantage point, how about the revolving restaurant at the top of the Hyatt in Dera? That's a niche suggestion.
But you get 360 views, so you can keep
you
an eye
on what's going on.
On what's going on and where they're swooping in from. Yeah, I love absolutely. That suggestion.
I'd imagine just picture you just sitting and just revolving and just seeing them charge across from, say, like downtown, but then just turning around and having to wait till you get back round again to see where they are.
Karthik is with me saying Topgolf is a great spot. Big field, uninterrupted visuals, gate and fence. I'm sure they got crowd control measures, shutters for closing time, easy in and out of the highway, close to a grocery store.
Whoa.
For scavenging. I'm with you. Let Robbie and Chris do their thing. Karthik is joining my crew down at Topgolf.
Nice. Did we have any other points from this fella? Or was that...
Listen, that was the gist of it. You know, basically, okay. You have to make sure you're close to an energy grid. Ideally, you probably want a truck of some sort so you can get on the go.
Here's one. If you've got the ability to shut off the lifts, right?
Yeah.
You get up to the top of the Burj Khalifa.
Mm.
You know, the office, there's apparently a secret one office right at the top.
Is there?
Apparently. You get all the food up there. Right in the lift, you then cut off the lift, because then if a zombie really wants you, they've got to do a heck of a lot of climbing of stairs to get you. You know, you're backing them, eventually giving out and thinking, to climb all the way to the top there, I ain't going to try it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, believe it or not, to add some credibility to this for Stephen, it turns out this is something that you can study in universities in the States. Zombie studies is a thing. In fact, the Florida governor... at the time, Ron DeSantis actually discussed this. He said, listen, zombie studies, I don't support this.
No wonder.
He was doing a higher education reform bill and basically said, I'm a big believer in higher education, but I'm not a believer in plunging people $150,000 into debt with a degree in zombie studies.
And he's not wrong.
A lot of the folk out there in the US are either hoarders and they are preparing for doomsday or the apocalypse or whatever. It might not be a zombie
That's
one.
That's a broad sweeping generalization most Americans are hoarders.
No, but come on. There's loads of TV shows that have gone into the homes of folk who have just got like stockpiles of weapons.
Yeah, they're maybe from Kansas and there's a lot of tornadoes.
Did we not do a feature on loads of billionaires who are just developing these unbelievable underground bunkers?
Yeah,
exactly that.
Cool.
So people are anticipating the end of the world.
Hold on a second. The last time I checked, there was 330 million plus people in America. Not all of them are billionaires, Rob.
Most of them are.
Most people in America are preparing for a zombie apocalypse.
Well, enough for it to warrant a course at the East Tennessee State University, at the very least.
Fair. Yeah, it did. And in fact, it's called Surviving the Zombie Apocalypse, an interprofessional approach. This is the description in the course study online. The zombie apocalypse has arrived. 17 of you were trapped on the University Park campus in the Hoos Library of Philosophy. You must work out what you are going to do to survive. The philosophical wisdom of the ages might help, or it might not.
Okay.
You will have to learn more about it in order to decide.
Well, Graham has delivered you the ultimate compliment, Soane, because he says this rivals the waterbed segment. Love it. And it feels like we've got a winner, because Tahil has been in touch to say IKEA is a great shout. So let's all go and enjoy the shawarmas and ice cream from there.
The Offscript Podcast.
We hope that you enjoyed this episode. Please do go ahead and click subscribe. You can also check out our other podcasts, Time Capsule or The Big Interview. Find it wherever you get your podcasts.